Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE, 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, and worldwide on www.irishradio.com. So, whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Center for Irish and Irish American Studies, inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman. Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned center for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you this morning from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, another busy week over here at Glucksman Ireland House NYU, and we're barreling through the semester and towards Thanksgiving. On Thursday night, we had the pleasure of having our annual Ernie O'Malley lecture, and my colleague, Professor Marion Casey, delivered a scintillating account of John Hughes, the first Irish-born Archbishop of New York, and the rationale behind the location of St. Patrick's Cathedral at its current location on Fifth Avenue. It's really remarkably fascinating, the story, and how Marion draws from the geographic and cultural surroundings of his home place in Ireland, some of the northern counties, Tyrone and Fermanagh, and the rationale and influence of that on where this cathedral, which is so celebrated, so much a signature part of the landscape of New York even today, and it's amazing to think about how this all came about. I look forward to playing excerpts of Marion's fantastic lecture on this in the very near future. On this week's program, I am delighted to give you the opportunity to hear the interview I was able to conduct with Donie O'Sullivan and Uisce Fogarty, who were here with us recently, marking the 100th anniversary of the New York GAA. They talked to me about a new documentary they were involved in called Aspects of Identity, an Enduring Tradition. This lovely documentary, folks, I do encourage you to go out and have a look and see if you can get a copy of it. It's a really fascinating insight into the social world and life of Gaelic Park and the GAA in the United States, in New York and in Chicago over the last few decades. So when they were here, Donie and Uisce, along with the filmmakers Christy Reardon and his son Anthony Reardon, and accompanied by John Sullivan, they also gave to the Archives of Irish America over 30 hours of raw footage that was captured as part of this documentary. And we're delighted to be able to preserve that in the Archives of Irish America, and we appreciate their vision in making that happen. So you'll hear my interview with Donie. Any of you who knows anything about football will know that Donie O'Sullivan is an All-Ireland winning Kerry footballer. I believe he captained the 1970 All-Ireland team. Now don't ask me to go any further, because the ins and outs of the GAA results wouldn't be my forte, but Donie's a good guy and he was a great advocate for us in terms of getting this material into a place where it would be consulted in the future, and it really is a great legacy to come out of this entire project. I'll also give you the opportunity to hear, I had the pleasure of interviewing and meeting for the first time award-winning author Emma Donoghue. Emma was in New York briefly during the week for an event. She was going to deliver a lecture at the 92nd Street Y, and she came down and took some time out of her busy schedule to have a chat to us about her new book, Frog Music, and about the process of writing, and about her as an Irish person living in Canada. For any of you who are familiar with literary critics, you may know that her father is Dennis Donoghue, who was a long-standing faculty member here at NYU, the Henry James Professor here at NYU for a long time, and taught classes with us here at Glucksman Ireland House. So we're delighted to have maintained that Donoghue connection in that way. So enjoy that interview with Emma. It was really interesting hearing her talk about the process of writing and all that. As you may also know, in recent weeks, we had the pleasure of holding a book launch here for Belfast Noir, which was an anthology of crime fiction published here in Brooklyn. And we had the pleasure of hosting Stuart Neville and Lee Child, two big names in the world of crime fiction on both sides of the Atlantic. They came in and had a chat with my colleague, Professor John Water. So I'm delighted to also share that interview with you. So we've a good mix of things between our GAA friends and Emma Donoghue and Stuart Neville and Lee Child. I hope you enjoy this week's programme.
I'm Professor John Waters from Glucksman, Ireland House. It's my distinct pleasure to welcome two leading voices in crime fiction, Stuart Neville and Lee Child, who are here to launch Belfast Noir, which Stuart Neville edited along with Adrian McKinty. It's published by Akashic Books in Brooklyn as part of their global cities of noir crime fiction. Stuart, I wonder if I could ask you to say a few words about the origin of the book.
Sure. I think it was about 18 months ago I got an email from Adrian McKinty, my fellow Northern Irish crime writer. And he'd been asked by Akashic Books to edit this installment of the noir series, and I guess it's a long overdue installment in Belfast Noir. And I jumped at the chance, thought a wonderful thing to do. And so we immediately put our heads together and started drawing up our list of authors that we'd like to invite to be involved. Now, there's a requirement with these anthologies for balance and gender and so on, also specifically within Belfast Noir of religious balance between Protestant and Catholic as well, if we could possibly do it. So, we had, you know, there's an abundance of writers to choose from within Northern Ireland and Ireland in general at the minute. So we basically started Belfast and radiated our way out from there. We filled all the slots very, very quickly, and the stories came in over maybe about 6 months.
Very good, yeah.
And each one as good as the last. You know, we were thrilled with the quality of the stories we were getting.
That's terrific. They're all tied, it seems, to places. There's a sort of map of Belfast that kind of emerges from the stories. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess it's a theme with the Akashic Books that they try to bring as much of the city as they can in specific areas. And we didn't actually have to give the writers any real guidance on that. You know, they each chose their own sort of stamping ground and covered them up pretty effectively from east, west, north, south.
Terrific. And of course, you've got a New York-based, British-born superstar crime fiction writer in Lee Child who's in the collection. We're delighted to have you here, Lee. Very welcome to Ireland House. What's your connection to Belfast, Lee?
My connection is my dad is a Belfast man. He was born there, grew up there. The family legend is he was born in a house that they eventually moved out of to go to a better house, but the house that they moved out of, they sold to a family called Morrison. And Van Morrison was the first baby born in that house.
Really, yeah.
And so, you know, we had these family roots in Belfast, and I think Stuart will understand this. In you know, my father left Belfast as a young man in his 20s, but his entire life, and therefore our family life, is dominated essentially by Belfast attitudes. You know, you can take the boy out of Belfast, you cannot take Belfast out of the boy. So I felt, you know, at least a half of an honorary Ulster man. And we would go and visit there a lot, which was sort of the jumping off point for my story in it, because I don't personally come from the city. I didn't grow up there. I wanted an outsider's point of view because that's what I always had as a kid. And it mystified me, quite frankly. I was born in England, and at a time when England was a very secular place. As a young child, I literally had no idea there was a thing called religion, let alone there were different sorts of religion. So I would then go to this city where my father would transform himself from this mild-mannered guy into this hostile man. There was something there that there was a sense of the other all the time. And as a little kid, I just frankly didn't understand it. I thought it was probably about soccer rivalry, because that's the nearest equivalent I'd ever seen. You know, one supporter against another. And of course, over the years, I learned more and more about it. And because I'm exceptionally old now, I can remember, you know, a good 10 years before the trouble started. I can remember the old Northern Ireland, how it used to be, probably throughout the whole 20th century.
Yeah. Did you go back often during the Troubles at all?
Yeah, we went back. You know, we had grandparents there, and they wanted to see us. So we went back, and until it got to the point where my English mother just refused that we should go anymore, because by this point, I think the last time I went, I was, you know, probably 16 or 17. And I could have looked like a soldier. There was a lot of danger. I mean, literally, there was a lot of danger.
Yeah, your accent,
my mother was probably exaggerating, but there was a sense of danger that you could be in, and the whole place was so uptight. My aunt, who I liked very, very much, lived in what was called Londonderry, now Derry. And at that time, there was just one bridge across the river there, a beautiful bridge with a fantastic view from the middle. So we would always have this habit of stopping in the middle of the bridge to take in the view. And we did this one time, and from both ends of the bridge, we had army trucks racing straight towards us. What were we doing? Were we planting explosives on it or something? So in the end, we stopped going. Then sadly, but inevitably, my grandparents died, and I lost touch with the place, really. I still have a cousin there, but I see her very occasionally.
Has it been in your imagination in terms of following the post-conflict transformation of the city?
Yeah, because what you know from observing these people close up is that you look anywhere else in the world for a grudge. Anywhere, you can look to the south of Italy, Sicily, you can look to all of these alleged hotspots in the world. They don't know from grudges. Grudges are an Irish thing. They've been around for 300 years or less, another 300. So observing this current process is incredible because there's a sort of psychopathic level of enmity that is somehow being held together by some kind of good intentions. And you've just got to hope it carries on.
I think Stewart's writing has been extraordinary for thinking about the psychological half-life, as it were, of the
children. The half-life, going to be amazingly long. And I've got to say, it was because of Stewart that I agreed to be in the book, because I was a big fan of his first couple of books, which I'd read by the time he asked me about this. And I always judge a project by who else is in it, and this is a great bunch.
Stewart, as you travel now around the States and around Europe, do you find people are aware that there's this wave of Irish crime fiction talent, and do people see that in your experience?
It's become a badly kept secret, I think, for a few years now. Our mutual friend Joe Long, for example, here in New York, has been an advocate for Irish crime fiction for quite some time. And it's been, and Lee has talked about the Scandinavian thing versus the Irish thing. We've been the next Scandinavian crime
for a decade more.
And I keep waiting for finally to reach that tipping point, and I hope it does at some point. But yeah, there's a growing awareness, and I think one of the best things about Irish crime fiction has been the sense of community that goes along with it. Now, the crime fiction scene is very warm and welcoming anyway. I mean, there's very little rivalry within crime fiction versus other genres. But Irish crime fiction in particular, everybody knows each other, and everybody helps each other out. Nobody's pulled the ladder up behind them. John Connolly, for example, is just one of the most generous people you'll ever meet, and will help everybody who comes along. And I think that sense of generosity and togetherness has been sort of passed down through the Easter wave of writers that comes along. I think it's a lovely thing, and it crosses the border and it crosses the religious divide as well. You know, there's no hint of North versus South or Protestant versus Catholic in this. It's family, really.
Yeah. It was 3 years ago that you were first here for the first crime fiction event where Culture Ireland brought over 8 Irish crime writers, and it was quite clear then that there was an incredible diversity of approaches to the genre and the form that were emerging. But then last year we had 18 crime fiction writers from Ireland in Dublin, along with Michael Connolly over. I'd say it would be the common assumption that John Connolly is seemingly connected to everyone and sort of supporting everyone, but it's lovely to see a collection that he's not in a way, given how remarkably supportive he's kind of been to the genre. If I can ask one last question, Stuart, what's the next project? What are you working on?
Just handed in my next book, that's my publisher's, which I think will come out in UK in June, hopefully, probably around this time next year, fall time in the States. And after that, I'm working on a TV adaptation of Ratlines for RTE, the Irish state broadcaster. Who knows if that'll come off? It's very early days, but keep your fingers crossed. And kind of off the back of that, I'm looking at writing a sequel to Ratlines, Max, as well.
Terrific, wonderful. And Lee, the 16th. Reach Your Novel is out. Is that
you're
right?
Behind the Times. 19th was out. I'm starting working on the 20th right now.
Wonderful.
As well as TV and movie distractions as well. So it's a question of just ignoring all that and trying to crank out some words over the winter.
Well, terrific. We couldn't be more pleased to welcome you both to Ireland House and to hear something from the book this evening. So thank you very much for coming in. We'll look forward to it.
Thank you very much.
All the best.
I'm here at Luxman Ireland House with 2 visitors. There's a fairly strong Kerry presence here at the best of times. As many of the listeners know, we have a Kerry man at the helm here, Professor Joe Lee. And my colleague, Professor Marion Casey, is the daughter of a Kerry woman. But we've a few more Kerry people here at the moment. We're delighted they're here to celebrate, and we're fantastically excited about the DVD, which is being launched. I suppose here tonight is the first launch of it here in the United States. Very good. Tales of New York, A Brief History of the GAA in America. And I have the pleasure and honour to be here with Weishi Fogarty and Donia O'Sullivan, who are here with us. tonight to celebrate. For any of you who haven't heard about it, it really is, if you have any interest in the GAA, in the social history of Irish migration to New York in the last 50, 60, 70, up to 100 years, this is something that should be high on the Christmas list, because it really gives a fantastic snapshot into the social life and culture of the people surrounding Gaelic Park. I have to say, though, as a woman, gentlemen, this isn't just about the sports, even if you've no interest in the sports, you know, in the athleticism as such of the Gaelic Games themselves alone. The social and cultural stuff around it is just very rich. Can I start off maybe by asking who got involved in this first? What was the genesis of this?
Well, I think it came from a DVD or a film that Weeshie and Christy Reardon made on the Kerry captains that took in, Homie were alive, and then the people who died, their families. And they put a huge amount of work into it.
Mm-hmm.
And even when they were doing it, I thought this would never come to fruition, but it did.
How long ago was the Kerry Captains DVD, Weeshie?
That was 5 years ago now, Marion, that the Kerry Captains DVD was brought out. It was a trio DVD in relation to the 36 Kerry Captains. We interviewed all those that were alive, and naturally enough, we couldn't interview those that were dead,
mm-hmm.
simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to their nearest, closest relatives. So it was a groundbreaking DVD, in my view, one of the best GA DVDs that was ever brought out. So from that originated this DVD in relation to New York, and Donnie Sullivan, in conjunction with Mickey Minehan here in New York then, Mickey Minehan brought us out in 2011. Donnie and Christy Reardon and myself came out, and we shot 30 hours of interviews and film in relation to the history of New York and GA. All voluntary, no profit making of any description. It was a labour of love, really.
So Weeshie, was it in the process of doing that first documentary that you realised how rich the history was here in New York?
It was indeed. And of course, coming over here myself on a personal basis and playing here in New York and meeting people and knowing people who had immigrated back in the 50s and all up along the lines, I knew myself, my own personal view, that GA New York was a huge part of everything here. And of course, everything centered along Gaelic Park. So we did know when we started off the interviews that Gaelic Park was going to be a huge part of the story. And we went back and we interviewed people from the 50s and 60s all up along, and the DVD explains all that story. I believe myself it's an absolutely fascinating story, and it's absolutely superb to see it come to fruition, Marion.
Absolutely.
I think it may have started really from a simple conversation with Mickey Minehan. Mickey had played for New York for so long here, and we were in his place talking about remembering things past and the 50s and the 60s. And whoever then talked about it would be great to record it, and Mick Minor really wanted that people from the 50s, 60s, 70s and ourselves were still around.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it came from that. Looking back, Weeshie, I think we were probably over ambitious that time, because it was so difficult and we had put it aside so often, and in fact it was probably abandoned last year that we couldn't get any further with funding or anything
mm-hmm.
else. So.
Well, because it's incredibly expensive and time consuming in terms of going around and doing these interviews. Correct?
Yeah, it is, Marion, but the one huge thing about it was there's a man living down in Castlevania, his name is Christy Reardon, and himself and his son Tony, they run the CR videos. Two of the most professional people I have ever met. The stuff that they produce would be equivalent, if not better, than what you would get on national television.
Mm-hmm.
And there, Christy became involved and became engulfed in all of this, and he gave his time and his effort and his money and everything into this. And then Donnie O'Sullivan, of course, with his name as a Kerry captain and great Kerry footballer too, and he had a lot of contacts here in New York. And with all that thrown together, then we came, as I say, in 2011, and we did 30 hours of filming. We met loads of people, fascinating people, going back to the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. We simply interviewed all of those people. We got their memories. We got their reminiscences. And the one thing that kept, two things kept coming through, the word Gaelic Park and the word John Kerry O'Donnell.
Mm-hmm.
They are the two things that kept shining through.
So what were the logistics, you know, here, and I've been explaining to you over the last couple of days that I've had the chance to have a chat to you. Here at NYU, we're the home of the Archives of Irish America, so we're very familiar with the process of interviewing. Now, we unfortunately don't have the opportunities that often for it to end up in a lovely documentary in the way with the video footage is fantastic and so powerful, I think. But what were the logistics for ye in terms of on the ground? Were there networks of contact contacts here? Were there people here who were bringing you around in terms of who was best to talk to, etc., etc.? How did that work?
Miriam, you summed it up there absolutely perfectly. Networks and people on the ground and the likes of Donny O'Sullivan, who had played out here and had lived out here and who had starred out here in Gaelic Park. He had an awful lot of contacts, and he put us in contact with one fella, another fella put in contact with another fella. Then Mickey Moynihan, of course, who had played out here in the 50s, immigrated from Rathmore in the county of Kerry way back in the 50s, and reputed to be the greatest Kerry footballer to ever immigrate. And Mickey put us in contact with other people, and one thing led to another, and the people that we uncovered and the people that gave us interviews and the people that met us was absolutely unbelievable. So one thing led to another, with the result that you're now looking at a DVD of 3.5 hours of stuff in relation to Gaelic football in New York. The one thing that came out of it, Miriam, was that really is there is no actual basis in New York for archival material except that you're having here now in Gluckman House, but there was no place, Donny, as
no,
such.
No.
Gaelic Park isn't owned by the GA here.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a little bit of a snag there, but the amount of people we met and the network we got through Donny and Mickey Mine and other people was simply mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm. And I think that kept us going to like playing a game or a championship, that we've got to finish it.
Mm-hmm.
And as they died so often, and just mention one name there that got it over the line for us was Hugh Freel, that I met up with an interest in games and history. Hugh came in because, again, just like here, the archives, and we spoke to him from Shannon Airport, and what he, regrettably he cannot be here,
right.
But he says, this DVD and this material will be appreciated properly in the future generations.
Mm-hmm.
And what's there as well, it isn't about the games, I think, which, you know, it isn't only the playing of the games, it's what went with them, social life, the contacts, the networking.
Getting a job, the practical parts of it, you know, and that's something that struck me, because I'd have limited knowledge of the background of the games and things
that,
but this really sheds light. Of course the games are important, that's why people were coming together, but there was so much more around Gaelic Park in the support and a place for Irish people to gather.
Yeah.
You know,
it was so important for them. And I think we should play many years. We played together and against them. But I'm sure we would say it wasn't medals were the great things or winning All Ireland. The most important things were the friendships and the camaraderie, not only of those you played with but against.
Mm-hmm.
And especially as we get older, you appreciate it more everywhere.
And the one thing, Miriam, that when I was doing the interviews, I was fortunate enough to be doing most of the interviews in it. The one thing that I was trying to emphasise all the time in the interviews until it comes shining through, I think, is where would the Irish immigrants in the 50s and the 60s have been without Gaelic Park? They had no place to congregate. They had no place to meet, only for Gaelic Park. And this is the one big thing. And also, we're here in 2014, now sitting down here with you in Gluckman House, New York. The same thing was happening in the 50s. That's what's happening today. Because as late as last night, I met two young men at a bus stop in New York who had come out from County Meath last week, and they were looking for a job going working in the buildings. And the people who came out in the 50s that are interviewed in that DVD and that the GA looked after when they came out here, they were the very same. So if you like, the wheel has turned full circle. The same thing is happening now as what happened in the 50s to those people that you'll hear interviewed. And the one thing is, they all were forced to immigrate, but only for the GA in New York, only for Gaelic Park, only for football. I think their lives would have been completely different.
Well, I have to say, in the interviews I've been doing here in the last 8 years since I've been in New York, Weishi, I've often interviewed mainly men, but sometimes women, but mainly men, whose very first stop, and I've interviewed one or two people, the very first day they came here, they went straight to Gaelic Park. You know, when you think about that, you've arrived off a boat or you've arrived in on a plane, and the very first place you're going to is Gaelic Park, especially if it's a Sunday, because in terms of the networks for jobs, for housing and for a bit of sport and fun and meeting your own. It was the port of call. It was such an important centre. One man I interviewed who, God rest him, he died in the last year or so, and he was a big man in Gaelic Park for a long time and got a lot of men jobs here, union jobs. John Kane was his name. John referred to the centrality of Gaelic Park, the GAA, as the internet of the time. It was the Facebook of the time in terms of exchanging information. People didn't have computers. That's where people went, and I think it's a great way of summing it up.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and just speaking of that now, some of the people that were interviewed, that we interviewed there, have already passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Bridie McManus, and the one we missed and we were waiting for him to come home, Jim Foley.
Yeah.
And Jim is gone also.
Yeah.
And so many more.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing about this DVD, Miriam, is it has really captured stuff that only for the DVD would definitely have been lost forever in the mists of time. Nobody would have interviewed all these people, only for Christy Reardon coming along with the DVD, only for the backing of the likes of Hugh Friel, and only for the likes of Donnie Sullivan, and the network of people that he knew here, with Mickey Moynihan. It can't be stressed enough. But also I should say that there's a big huge section of the DVD concerns the GA in Chicago. That's also in it. And the same thing is concerned inside there about Gaelic Park in Chicago and how the GA was so influential to the people in the 30s, the 40s and the 50s and the 60s there. So the DVD said it's a brief history of New York because, Donny, we couldn't encapsulate it at all.
That was
impossible. Possible. There are people in it that maybe should be in it, but we couldn't get it off to everyone.
And then again, as I said, it was voluntary. And that's what's the most important thing, are the hours of film that are going to be in the archives here. That we hope that people will, in days to come, check them out. And for instance, there's, I think, a wonderful interview, Michal O'Shea, in the Irish language. And there'll only be a few minutes on the DVD subtitles, but the information he has, the history of Dunanore and so forth, back where he comes from, and a writer out in San Francisco who's buried there from that area, and his family and so forth. It's a great interview for somebody who's interested in that. And in coming days, I think we hope and we expect people will look up that when we're long gone.
And not alone, Miriam, is there interviews all done in New York, but when we went back to Ireland, we went up to Northern Ireland, and we interviewed a huge load of people in Northern Ireland. For instance, legendary players like Jim McKeever of Derry, Sean O'Neill of Down, and all their stories are in it in relation to their years and their time and their trips to America and to New York playing football. Mick O'Connell, one of probably the greatest Gaelic footballers in the history of the game. Long interview with him about his time here. Maurice Fitzgerald, the great Kerry footballer. Mickey Whelan of Dublin. People like that, they're all in the DVD talking about their time in New York, the people they met, and there's a very important interview with Kerry O'Donnell, whose late father was John Kerry O'Donnell, who was the, I suppose, the grandfather or the father of GA in this city.
Mm-hmm.
And only for John Kerry O'Donnell and his work in Gaelic Park, maybe we wouldn't be here today. But Kerry O'Donnell talks about her dad.
Fantastic. Back to the Reardons, and I want to come on to you two in a minute as well. But in my experience, the best documentaries are what is evident in what Christy and his son have done in this DVD, that it is a labour of love. It's not about the money. It's not about producing something. It's been driven by something that's far beyond any dollar amount, any euro amount, or any consideration of time. And I really think it's fair to say that you can see this in the DVD.
That's very important. If you saw that, we're very pleased, because even coming out this time now, the four of us, five, everyone pays their own way and pay for themselves. Because there's no, Christie's already down money in this. I think it's something like maybe playing football or hurling. When it's amateur, there's even a better kick out of it.
Marion, on the very same point in relation to Christy Reid and his son Anthony, and the work that they have been doing, is their work is of the highest standard that you can get. And everything they do in relation to what we're discussing here this evening is definitely a labour of love. Because I can tell you, without fear of contradiction and without a shadow of doubt, it's costing him lots and lots and lots of money to produce what we are actually doing. So there's no financial gain for Christy Reardon. It's a real labour of love. And he's a Kerry man, he's from Castlevine, and the work that he's doing is absolutely superb. But I tell you this, it's absolutely wonderful that the likes of the Glucksmann House here in New York are there to accept what he is doing. And we're only delighted to be handing over what we're doing here this evening, handing over to you, so future generations of Irish-Americans and Irish people coming out here will have some place where they can go, where all this is saved, and where it's all captured.
Well, we're kindred spirits, we, she, in the fact that, you know, Marion Casey single-handedly over 20 years ago started saving stuff and salvaging stuff, things that were being thrown out. And over the years that culminated, I believe in 1997, the Archives of Irish America was formed. And the thing that comes to mind as I'm talking to you, and it's a word that's very much in our mind, as we think about what's in the archive already, is legacy. the legacy that's been left behind and the footage that you've collected. Sometimes Marion and I say, oh, we wish we'd have more hours in the day that we could go into the archive and actually refer and use the stuff. We've kind of resigned ourselves to the fact that we're doing the hard work in terms of the collecting, getting the stuff in so that in 5, in 10, in 50 years' time, there is a repository for the Irish in the United States, because unbelievably, given the length and the scale of Irish migration to this country, there wasn't a centralised place before this. And New York's a great location. With open arms, we take what you've done, because you're doing it in the same vein as we are in passion for it. We have the luxury of doing it. We get paid vaguely to do what we do and we enjoy it. But it's just fantastic because we, as you've said yourselves, you can only do but so much. So the fact that you've got some of those people that we've been trying to get for years and people who've since died, it's such a wonderful gift for Irish America. I have to say, you, Uishi, in terms of the interviewing, because of your background as a player and things like that, because of your profile in GAA circles, I mean, that's brought a richness to the interviews you've done. You're talking to people who were passionate about the sport and everything, and you're not, say, the likes of me or someone else coming in who didn't know what you're talking about. You're able to talk to them in a very intimate way about the sport and the passion of it, right?
Well, Marion, I would be involved in Gaelic football all my life, like, and I have great admiration for all Kerry footballers, like Donny O'Sullivan here now, who I played with, and he captained Kerry. And there's one interview in the DVD with a man by the name of Dennis Bernard of Cork.
He used to play with the Donnies.
He used to play with the Donnies, right? But when I was a young man growing up in Killarney in the 50s, I had a 10 months of finals in the Fitzgerald Stadium in Killarney. And way back in 1955 and 56, I remember distinctly in my mind's eye, sitting up on the wall of Fitzgerald Stadium, watching Cork playing Kerry, and watching Dennis Bernard playing for Cork. Now, I never met the man until 2011, when we came out to do the interviews here, and lo and behold, somebody said, would you like to interview Dennis Bernard of Cork? And I said, Dennis Bernard? I mean, he's the name out of my past. And we brought to his house, to his flat, wherever he was, and that interview is on it. And then one more thing, you're talking about how the importance of the past. The late, great John B. Keane said to me one time, and I never forgot it, and we were discussing things like this, and he said, Uishi, he said, if you forget your past, you have no present. And if you have no present, how can you have a future? So that's what we are trying to be doing, is preserving our past.
And there's just, as a parting shot, there's a great interview, one of the best, I think, here, with Joe Lee. Joe's the director here on the GAA.
In the DVD?
In the DVD.
Oh, I didn't get to that part.
Yeah. When we were here that night 3 years ago, and I never knew he knew so much, not only about the games, but the GAA as it is, its good points, its weak points, and so forth. But it's an excellent, as all his interviews, like, it's a flow of eloquence as usual.
But
so it's a,
and that's the thing though, Donny, and you've seen this probably more than any of us in terms of the GAA though, as far as I know, and I know Joe won't mind me saying this, Joe never really played himself, but I know from being around him for as long as I've been around him, he can recount matches and scores and the results and everything in a way that is like photographic memory. And that's one of the things about the GAA though, how it brought people in who weren't even just the players, because I'm talking to someone now who was top of his game, literally.
The local.
Yeah.
The local.
And the I people was, who didn't play could, you know, themselves, you know, could appreciate
and
it and enjoy
club,
it.
And the smaller club, you know, from West Cork or from Kerry or anything else, that's the base for the whole thing. And the people associated with the club and the community. When that goes, we're gone. That base, that love of what we spoke about there, people that don't have to play or anything else, to be interested and to enjoy.
When you think about it, that's a lot of what we do here at Luxembourg Ireland House, is thinking about how, in this case, we're looking at the Irish, how the Irish are replicating the sense of community we've grown up with at home.
Yeah.
And I try to explain that to undergrads here when I'm teaching about it, you know, and I explain to them how, at a certain point in time, people would prefer to marry within their own county, God, within their town land or parish if they could. And over time, identity has changed. And to Americans or to New Yorkers, it seems kind of strange, and the clannishness of the Irish. And you have to see it in the historical context of how Ireland Ireland's geography and history developed, and Joe talks about this all the time, things change completely once the railway comes in and people can move around. But I will still interview people, the likes of the people on the DVD, who before they came to this country hadn't gone much further than 20 miles from their home. They'd only gone as far as a bike could take them.
And there's a saying in the Irish language, which I think would be the reason we probably did this, Ní vegele héidí ar a rís. Their likes, our old likes, will not be here again.
Well, bhí mí hála chórna an seo I mí bhean flóra mhí lehan ag a fheir itas an Vlascaid Mór, tá sé na chóní Springfield, Massachusetts.
Mí hála chórna.
Mí hála chórna, bhí sé an seo. Yeah.
So, mí lehan am ága mhí.
But bhí an rud sin imo bhion leis, nor bhí sé caint leis, ní vega le héad an seo a rís.
But Mary's last word, not alone are we launching the DV here tonight down Luxman Island House, but also Christy Reardon is handing over 30 hours of unedited material. So there's nearly 35 hours of material that was shot here in Ireland and in New York in relation to the Gaelic Games being handed over here tonight. So you're also getting all the unedited stuff, including hours and hours about the GA and the people in Chicago and much, much more.
Well, we're absolutely delighted to place this in the rich collection that, as I mentioned, my colleague Marion Casey ostensibly started herself all those years ago. This is a fantastic gift to Luxman Ireland House and us as custodians of the Archives of Irish America. I hope that this will be the start of more conversations, and again, thank you for bringing this to our attention, for giving us the honour of it being the US launch of it. And if anyone wants to buy the DVD, I suppose the best thing to do is probably to go to Christy Reardon's website, is that right?
Yes, it'd be the best thing.
So it'll be Christy Reardon, RIORDAN videos.com, and you'll be able to purchase it there, and we're delighted to have them available tonight. I can't recommend it enough. I know many of the listeners to this program will very much enjoy and will recognize a lot of familiar faces in it, and as I said, the added bonus of us getting the raw footage, as those in the business refer to it, for the Archives of Irish America is more than we could have asked for, and we're just so delighted, Donny, for your role. I know has been particularly strong in advocating for us and suggesting here as a home for it. Thanks, gentlemen.
You're welcome.
I have the pleasure to be here at Luxman Ireland House, NYU, on a very rainy, rather Irish-looking weather out there, isn't it, Emma? With Emma Donoghue. We're immensely grateful that she's taken time out of her very busy schedule and limited schedule here in New York City, ostensibly for the event you're doing at the 92nd Street Y.
Yes, I'm getting to read with Ruth Rendell at the 92nd Y, and what's great fun for me is that although this particular novel, Frog Music, is a murder story, it's my first crime story, so to be paired with Ruth Rendell, I feel like I've been, you know, let into the pantheon of crime writers just for one evening.
That was one question I wanted to ask you, Emma. Are you very familiar with Ruth's work?
I like her work a lot. I especially like her Barbara Vine thrillers, the very psychological ones. They really get under your skin, yes. I think she's superb.
So maybe, and I should mention for any of our listeners who don't know, Emma is the daughter of a long-standing faculty member and well-known personality here on the NYU campus over decades, Professor Dennis Donoghue, a well-known literary critic and a former Henry James professor here at NYU. So you're not totally unfamiliar with us here at Luxman Ireland House, Emma.
Indeed, I'm very familiar with the place and all its splendours.
So am I right in thinking that when you came to New York at the age of 10, it was your first time here?
I was only 9 and it just blew my mind because, you know, I'd gone to non-run schools in Dublin and I came here and I remember being a bit confused at the time that my parents put me and my sister into a private Episcopalian school, and I remember thinking, aren't we Catholics? I realised afterwards that class had kind of superseded religion there because they were afraid of the local public schools, you know, they'd heard about knifings and so on. So they popped us into St. Luke's School in the village, and even in that sort of protected setting, New York was just so dazzlingly different. You know, my friend's school had divorced parents. you know, and there was racial diversity and everything diversity in New York. It just completely stunned me. And I think that's why I've ended up emigrating twice, first to England and then to Canada. It felt as if that year shook me awake and everything was so different and so vivid. I think every child should go through something like that.
When I was thinking about that over the weekend, it struck me that the village and New York has changed profoundly since you were there then.
I'm sure it has. There's been a lot of tidying up of New York, hasn't there? A lot of cleaning up, yeah. I mean, you couldn't walk through Washington Square without being offered dope in those days. And even my first day at school, even though it was this private school, I was offered marijuana. But luckily, I was offered it in the form of a cigarette, so I knew it must be evil. If it had been in the form of a brownie, my life would have taken a different course. Yeah, because I couldn't say no to a brownie. But yeah, it was just the city. It did feel very lively in those days. And even the honking of the taxis and, you know, watermelons, everything seemed on a bigger, more colourful scale. And even though we went back to Dublin after that year, I was permanently changed by it.
Well, that's really interesting how it had such a profound effect on you. I'd like to ask you a little bit about being, as you mentioned, you'd moved to England to undertake your PhD at Cambridge in the late 90s. Have you any thoughts on what it was like to be Irish in Britain in that period of time, or was that something that was...
I had such a false preconception there. I had the impression that England was rife with anti-Irish feeling. And no doubt it was if you were a bricklayer. Do you know what I mean? But if you were a graduate student coming to Cambridge on a scholarship, there was no anti-Irishness. You know, people loved my accent. There was just a complete welcoming of my Irishness, I felt, and I met other Irish people in England too. And I kept waiting for that anti-Irish sentiment to kick in, and it never did, you know, in those particular circles. So I had a wonderful 8 years there. And actually, that was a very formative experience too, because I realised that England and Ireland, we often exaggerate their differences because of the political history between us. But really, you know, these people had grown up watching the same television as I had. You know, we were all Top of the Pops watchers. And we'd grown up reading many of the same books. So I really realised that the British Isles can share a real common culture. Just as now I live in Canada, you know, we tend to exaggerate the differences between Canada and the States. But again, there's quite a common culture and common experiences.
Did you ever or would you ever have thought of remaining permanently in England? It's a place you like to live.
I easily might have lived there, yes, but I happened to fall for a Canadian, so suddenly I had to head off again. Just as all my friends were moving back to Ireland, it seemed, in the late 90s, I suddenly had to emigrate again. But emigration is very good for a writer, you know. We should never get too comfortable. We should always be slightly on the hop.
Your relationship brought you to Canada. So you've been in Canada 14 years or so?
Yeah, no, I went in 98. It's been 16 years now. Yeah.
So has there been a change that you have felt in terms of being Irish in Canada over that period of time, or is it something that you're conscious of?
I've always felt welcomed as an Irish person in Canada. You know, Canada, I think the part I'm in, Ontario, it's absolutely full of people from the British Isles in general, and I think they see the Irish as a core element of that culture. You know, and I've often been to say Irish studies events in, say, Toronto or Nova Scotia, you know, so I think Irish culture is quite thriving in Canada. They love Irish-based folk music, for instance. I love what they do with it on the east coast of Canada, you know, kind of high-speeded up Celtic trad, you know, it's exhilarating stuff by bands like Great Big Sea. I think I'm lucky in that even though I've emigrated twice, it's always been to places where my Irishness was actually a familiar part of the cultural mix around me. I've really never moved to a culture that I found alien. So they've been fairly easy emigrations to English-speaking places.
Yeah.
But actually, nowadays, because my partner is French and sometimes on her sabbaticals or exchanges, we've been to France for a year. And there, I feel far more foreign. There, I have to work a bit harder at everyday life.
Right.
But it's not really brutal labour to have to try and settle into the south of France as you sit there eating your pain au chocolat.
Well, I think it's something that we don't sometimes pay enough attention to, Emma, in terms of the act of migration when there's no linguistic leap to jump, you know. And I often think of, you know, the Irish immigrants going back over time who were leaving with only speaking Irish, that it must have been just so much more difficult and things like that. I think we forget that because we tend to move in these English-speaking circles academically and in other ways sometimes. The main reason you're here in New York, Emma, is to talk about your most recent novel, Frog Music. It's set in late 19th century San Francisco. A fascinating story. For those of our listeners who are not familiar with the book yet, can you just give us a little bit of background to it?
Well, it sounds improbable in that a journalist once came up to me and said, "You see, there's a hoax on your Wikipedia page." He said, "They're saying that you're writing a novel about the murder of a cross-dressing frog catcher in 19th century San Francisco." And I had to say to him, "Yes, what's funny about that?" So Jenny Bonnet caught frogs for a living for the restaurant trade, and so she'd wander around the marshes of San Francisco, and she wore trousers, but then she'd leave her trousers on in the evening. And so she would get regularly arrested by the San Francisco police. She was pretty much the only person they were using their anti-cross-dressing law against. So she was this well-known local troublemaker and picked fights in bars, and she'd had a past in sort of juvie. So she was this extraordinary and genuinely funny character. I mean, in the record she's left on the historical record, her sense of humour comes across. You know, she would wisecrack with the police and with the journalists, and she'd joke around in court, pay her fine, and then go out into the streets again. Anyway, somebody shot her through a window in 1876. And there was another woman in the room at the time, a French burlesque dancer, and it's never been clear who was the main target. When I came across this case about 15 years ago, I just thought, oh, that one is for me. I have to write about that particular case. Partly because Jenny Bonnet was just the perfect murder victim. You know, in real life, random people get killed. But in fiction, you sort of want, I remember this from studying Macbeth at school, you want plot to grow out of character. You want there to be a lovely feeling of fittingness about it. So Jenny Bonnet was just the right kind of devil-may-care person to get shot down at 26. And so I wrote Frog Music to explore that crime. And so it's a murder mystery, but more. I'm very interested in themes like, say, the damage done to children in many ways. And the kind of, I mean, I wanted, you know, to give a proper solution. I hate when literary writers turn to crime fiction and they think they can suspend any closure and not give any answers at the end. I think that's just annoying. So, you know, it's a murder mystery with a traditional ending, but I also wanted to explore the kind of ramifications of guilt in more than one character. So I so enjoyed writing it. And especially the San Francisco setting. I mean, no more thrilling city have I ever had to write about, you know.
And so you immersed yourself in late 19th century San Francisco.
I did, and people often say to me, oh, did you go and live there? You know, and I just try to imagine trying to sell that to my partner and kids, you know. So no, I never went for more than a few days. But, of course, through the wonders of the internet, you can pretty much live in any time and place. So I read guidebooks from the time, maps, lots of photographs. There are wonderful archives of photographs of the lost San Francisco, the San Francisco that then crumbled and burned in 1906. And most of my characters were living in Chinatown, which was a particularly shabby little ghetto where the balconies almost touched overhead. It was so crowded. And it couldn't have been better for me that the summer I was writing about, 1876, they had a terrible heat wave and also a smallpox epidemic. So the novel is actually very factual, but has these naturally dramatic elements to it that I didn't even have to make up. So
it strikes me, Emma, it's one of those stories that it sounds like it's fictitious completely, right? You couldn't make this up, and it is grounded in reality. As you're talking, I'm not sure that this played any role in Frog Music. It's a very Irish city, late 1870s and 1880s.
It's true, there were lots of them there. One thing I was trying to work out was, if my main characters had had a maid, who would the maid have been? And I found that most young Americans were completely unwilling to do service work. They found it demeaning. They'd prefer to be off in factories. So I found that the maid could have been Irish or could have been Swedish. So I went for Swedish because I already had a cast of Irish characters. And when Jenny Bonnet was shot through a window, she was in a particularly scuzzy little two-room bar hotel on the outskirts of San Francisco. And the family she was staying with were an Irish family. And we know quite a lot about them because at her inquest, they had to come forward and testify. Father and the daughter, and they just sound so shambolic and drunk and disreputable. And I thought, this is great, because if I was just setting out to make up an Irish family, I might feel a bit bad about portraying them as such wasters and losers and drunks, but no, these ones are all historical, so I have to feel free. So I let myself create this hideous family with, you know, bad cooking, and, you know, they're pathetic the way they stood up and lied at the inquest, for instance. And the father stood up and said, oh, I thought Jenny Bonnet was a man. And very odd, because clearly she'd known him for years, she came and stayed regularly. When she died, she was in his nightshirt that he lent to her, you know. So I think the family were just trying to dissociate themselves from a cross-dresser by saying, we had no idea she was cross-dressing.
That's fascinating. So Slammerkin was your first major shift into historical fiction, Emma, is it?
That's true, and that was 2000, so it's been 15 years now, yeah. And for some reason I tend to, my historical novels have all been fact-inspired, and this is just doubling my labours. It's not a practice I would recommend to anyone. But for some reason, for me, it works. There's something about the, you know, the rough texture of fact that stimulates my imagination so much. So I just love the sort of double labour of researching what really happened and being as scrupulous as a historian, and then saying to myself, okay, now you can make up the rest.
Do you think that there's some linkage in that between someone of an academic background, you know, the skills and discipline you acquire in the process of undertaking a major research project like a PhD, that means that writers with that background are more predisposed to undertaking that kind of writing?
Yes, so they don't always turn to historical fiction, but I am an academic gone wrong, definitely, and I so enjoy the sort of, for instance, you know, concepts that were very current when I was doing my PhD, like revisionism. I love the idea of taking the past and giving a new and more accurate slant on it, you know. When I was writing Slammerkin, for instance, I had to have a slave character in there because people generally don't know that there was slavery in countries like Britain. They think of it as a purely American South problem. So, yeah, I love that feeling of especially finding the long forgotten and the obscure. You know, I've written a lot about characters who were freaks or oddities or, you know, cult leaders or put on show in freak shows. I'm fascinated by stories of the odd and the peculiar and the rare and what they can say about the everyday. You know, so I love to take a character like Jenny Bonnet, who was so odd, and actually find in her the kind of representative young drifting American. So yeah, I've loved applying my academic skills to fiction. But I write contemporary fiction too, and I wouldn't want to give up either one, you know? Mm-hmm. It's easier to be funny in contemporary fiction because you've got shared cultural reference points with the reader. So, you know, sometimes I like writing a short story which is probably inspired by my life experience, just something completely pedestrian, like agonizing over paint colors for your house. And I like sometimes that very light, modern, everyday, deceptively ordinary setting, as opposed to the kind of more obvious lurid thrills of San Francisco in the middle of a plague.
Can I ask you, Emma, for any aspiring writers out there, what's your routine in terms of writing? Do you write every day? Is there a place?
Well, one oddity about me is that I write on a treadmill, because I realised that my lifestyle of sitting around and reading and writing from the age of 4 on, I'm 45 now, I thought this is going to kill me. Sitting is so bad for you, especially middle-aged women. So I, sight unseen, bought a very expensive treadmill desk. And I knew that the fact that I paid so much money for it would commit me to using it, at least for the first few months, you know. And it's been about a year and a half, and I love it. So I spend about half my working day walking slowly, like 2.5 miles an hour, on this treadmill while typing at my laptop. And then the rest of the time, sitting and writing. But it's salvation, because I might walk 10 miles in a day. Well, I haven't, you know, lost a pound or anything, but I feel much healthier. You know, I run up the stairs like my mother has always done. So, yeah, I think it's going to, my hope is that it'll keep me writing into my 80s, you know. Because my dad, who you mentioned, you know, he's a constant rebuke to me in that he's still publishing away at 86. So he definitely makes me feel I have to keep the energy level up.
I mean, he only gave up teaching, what, about 3 years ago?
Yeah, yeah, he's tireless. And also he's always been such a model to me for the breadth of his interests. You know, he didn't specialise. He's always had something interesting to say about pretty much anything. Mm-hmm. And just his single-minded love of literature. I grew up really soaked in that.
So do you write every day, Emma? Is that a
discipline? I do. Occasionally, well, I don't set myself a number of words or anything. I've never had to because I like the writing. But it's more that sometimes I do find that I allow the kind of administration of my career, you know, travel arrangements and contract negotiations, sometimes that gets in the way for a day or two, and then I'll think, oh, this is ridiculous. I want to be just writing. But it almost feels like I'm just clearing away the undergrowth so I can get into the heart of the forest, you know?
And would you, at any given point in time, ever only be working on one major project, or are you...
No, I've always got a few. I see it like cultivating a garden, you know? So I'm writing away on my next adult novel, which is set in 19th century Ireland, and also I'm sort of about to do a redraft on a children's novel I've been writing. But then I'm also in negotiations for a film of Frog Music. And I'm going up to the set of the film of my novel Room in Toronto. I'm going up there once a week. So, yeah, I'm always multitasking. I mean, not in any given hour I'm only working on one thing. Mm-hmm. But definitely I have a few projects. And that's very refreshing. Because especially if you're, you know, working away on one quiet, bleak scene in the morning, to be writing a little bit of contemporary comedy in the afternoon is... a change is as good as a rest, you know?
Are you looking forward to seeing Room on film?
So much. And Lenny Abrahamson, the director, you know, it's funny, he said he knew when he wrote to me first that I'd be going, an Irish director? What do I want an Irish director for this novel set in America? But it was the most brilliant 10-page letter. It quoted Plato, you know, he's a philosophy graduate. I knew he completely understood the book, and that his films, they're so sort of full of heart, you know? So I knew it wouldn't be a sort of cold-bloodedly arty project either. And his films are full of caring and yet they're never sentimental. We decided to work together to develop this, and so it's an Irish-Canadian co-production spending the tax dollars of both my nations, so it better work. You know, I don't want to waste those tax dollars.
So you're quite involved then in the
process? I'm very involved. I'm the screenwriter, and for years I nagged Element, the company. I kept saying, make it in Toronto. Toronto's good as an American city. Go on, make it in Toronto. So they are making it in Toronto with almost all Canadian actors, but a few American actors. Like, we have Brie Larson as the mother, and we have Joan Allen as the grandmother, William H. Macy as the grandfather, and a superb little Canadian boy playing Jack. He's actually 8, but he looks absolutely tiny and young, so he looks like a 5-year-old. I've been going up to the shoot regularly, and it's always the director's film, but as the screenwriter, I've been really as involved as the writer could possibly be, and I think it's been a remarkably cushy experience for me, because usually if you go with a big studio, they keep you at a distance. Whereas because this is a small company and because we've been working really together from the start to develop the project, I feel really fully involved.
You have the kind of relationship with Lenny in terms of being able to say, oh, I really don't like what you're doing with that part of it.
Absolutely. And the crucial thing is, you don't stand up and say, oi, I didn't like that take. You know, you keep your mouth shut and you wait till lunchtime and then you say, about that scene, Lenny. You know, you do it behind the scenes, like, you know, Mary interceding with our Lord. That sort of relationship. She is our Lord.
So when is it due out?
Probably next autumn, I'd say. But it's going splendidly. And I've been seeing the rushes. This is all my new film vocabulary, as you talk about. We're looking at the rushes every day. I get to see all these on a website. So, again, I didn't realise I'd get to see the footage as I went along. So they've been really kind in sort of letting me into the process. Because, you know, by tradition, filmmakers think of writers as interfering and trying to keep them at arm's length. Mm-hmm. But I would say an Element have really let me in. And even though I hadn't been looking for an Irish company, it is true we all work effortlessly together. You know, there's a common language that we mock each other regularly. I noticed once we were on the phone to an American company who are helping to fund it. And, you know, myself and Lenny and Ed Guiney, his longtime sort of work partner, the producer of the film, we were just naturally cracking jokes in a very dry tone of voice. And I was noticing some silence from the New York end of the line. And I was thinking, okay, they don't necessarily get what we're doing here, you know.
Do you often go home to Ireland? Is that important to you?
Every few months, yeah. And that's been true for all the time I've been away. I don't think I've ever been home less than twice in a year. Because, of course, Ireland's been through such extraordinary changes that if you stayed away for a year, you'd feel like a complete stranger there. Mm-hmm. You know?
And do you bring the kids there?
Quite often, yeah. They're very comfortable there. I think mostly it's that when we go there, we immediately let them live off Tato, you know. I suspect that's what's earned their love for Ireland. But they also like things like music in pubs, and they just enjoy the city, roaming over the city in places like the Ark Children's Centre.
So we're saying that they haven't been to New York?
No, but they've been to Dublin plenty, yeah. It's so more important for them to know their homeland.
Yeah, you'll have to get them down here soon. Well, listen, Emma, thank you so much. We really appreciate you coming in today on this early hour of a miserable Monday morning. Thank you so much for giving up some of your time and
it's
for coming the whole way down. I hope that the event at the 92nd Y goes really well.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm John Waters. I'm the director of the MA program in Irish and Irish-American Studies at Glucksman Ireland House at New York University. This is an interdisciplinary MA programming encompassing the study of history, literature, music, language, and culture. We're now accepting applications for fall 2015, and generous scholarship money is available. We'd like to invite you to visit Ireland House for an MA program open house with faculty, current students, and alumni. That'll be held on Friday, December 12th, from 5 to 7 p.m. Hope to see you there.
We're coming towards the end of the program for another week. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM, on HD Radio, and on www.irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, you can email us on ireland.house@nyu.edu. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanley Show up next on WBNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, stay with us here until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus fanacht.